Welcome to The Network Break, a Packet Pushers podcast on the latest news from the tech industry with analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Connery Murray, and joining me from across the Atlantic is the unmistakable Greg Farrow. Greg, how are you today?
Not too bad. It's been a long week this week for some reason, even though it's only Thursday. We're recording a day early, so we might be short term news, but we'll catch it up next week, I'm sure.
Absolutely. We'll make up for it. Also joining us today is a special guest, Russ White. Russ is a longtime network engineer, and you've probably seen his blog or read stuff that he's written all over the place. Russ, how are you?
I am fine. I'm working on a Cisco certified architect scenario. Isn't that exciting?
Delicious. Thanks for jumping in with us, Russ. And before we start, I want to thank today's sponsor, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint root causes of network issues wherever they occur, and then share your insights with vendors and customers. You can sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see. So jumping into the show, a few weeks back, like I think in December, Juniper had some security problems. There was a remote access vulnerability and some serious crypto problems. They have subsequently fixed that, and now they're trying to move on.
Yeah, but it got worse this week because not only was there a hardwired backdoor, it turns out their random number generator uses a dual EC algorithm, and apparently that algorithm has been known insecure since 2000-something. And they didn't pick it up and they didn't replace it. And that's pretty grim.
Been known to be weak for a long time. And so it turned out that the weakness was exploitable in Juniper's implementation. Juniper has said that they have fixed the weakness. They're still using the random number generator currently, but they're promising to have it replaced in the ScreenOS software sometime by the first half of 2016.
Yeah. So let's just make sure we highlight this. ScreenOS is an obsolete product and you shouldn't have it in your network.
Greg, why don't you just say it? Yeah, that's great. Right.
The reality, of course, is that most people have still got ScreenOS all over the place because replacing firewalls is hard because vendors make them deliberately hard to replace. But that's no excuse. You should have replaced it and spent money on it. So if you've got ScreenOS, bad you. But this does leave a lot of questions in my mind about just how good is Juniper at developing secure software because – you know, even if this is obsolete software, this particular dual EC vulnerability, which the suggestions are it's actually an NSA thing because they designed the algorithm. If that's true, then there's, you know, definitely naughty stuff going on. This leaves a lot of questions about whether Juniper is the right sort of company to be developing secure software if they haven't been able to pick this up in, you know, 10 years of producing this code. As I raised when we first talked about this, the question is, was it internally, was it malicious? It probably was the company involved. If not the company, was it a person? If the persons were involved, are they compromised? And now it's no longer clear as to, with all of these vulnerabilities, it's actually probably all of the above.
I think it actually raises even broader questions about technology companies and security. You can't rely on firewalls are not magic, and you can't rely on the things, and you've got to be a little bit more intelligent about using this type of technology. And furthermore, computers, I mean, as much as we want to say, ooh, I can algorithmize this whole security thing and make it perfect, sorry, not happening. The random number generator is a perfect example of this. Computers don't do random number generation very well. It's just the way it is. I mean, we need to be more intelligent about this stuff and be more of engineers and less of purchasers of product. Well, and
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, these are failings of the development process. Substandard RNGs being implemented in code so the encryption is easily crackable. Hardwired backdoors in the SSHs. Yeah. These are things that should be subject to regular code review and should be easily discovered by any sort of competent software checking. You know, just automated software checking, looking for hardwired SSH backdoors should be part of it. Like, for example, this week, an older Fortinet vulnerability came out where about 18 months ago, they had a hard-coded SSH vulnerability in version 4 and early version 5 of the code. For 3 or 4 years, these firewall companies who run around telling everybody how great they are actually just lying. They're actually doing a really bad job of making their product secure, right? I made a joke and said, you've just got to assume that, you know, all US-owned firewalls are suspect at this point in time. And somebody came back and said, what about the others? And I said, well, if you're buying a product from a Chinese manufacturer or an Israeli manufacturer, Israel is a very popular place for generating security products because there's a business model developed in Israel where they take security developments from inside of Mossad and then commercialize them as a way of generating government revenue for the country. And you've just got to assume that the Israeli government has already backdoored anything that's been done in that country, because that's the sort of thing that they would do.
Firewalls aren't really secure anyway, right? I mean, you've got to firewall your firewall. I mean, what do you do, right?
And the cost of having two firewalls in front of a system is just so unbelievably expensive. Not just purchasing two firewalls, but operating two firewalls.
Greg.
No, I'm serious. I mean, I've worked in enterprises who do have three layers of firewall, and they have a stateful firewall front and back, and in the middle is proxies. That's standard right. DMZ design. So in the front, you'll put one vendor, and in the back, you'll put a different vendor. And the stated reason is so that if one vendor's insecure, the other one won't be.
Wow.
And that's been standard design for 20 years. That's not new. That's been that way since 1996, when the Checkpoint Firewall product, which was running on top of Windows NT, by default, it allowed all the packets to go straight through.
I was going to say, I mean, it just seems like to me, this just points more and more to, you know, as I've always said, you've got right now in security, you have castle walls versus cannons, and the cannons are winning. We need to think outside the castle wall, and that's just all there is to it. We're past it.
I think the scariest thing for me was the fact that these vulnerabilities in the ScreenOS source code didn't get found for such a long time, and that I think does call into some question Juniper's development practices. Although I should say that they've said they brought in a third party to do a top to bottom review of the ScreenOS code, and they also did some quote unquote hotspot checking on their JunOS software. The JunOS source code, they looked at the VPN code, the encryption code, and authentication. So I think they feel like they've been stung by this. They're trying to demonstrate that they are taking code review more seriously. But this should be standard practice for everybody who's selling security software or any security product, that the software that runs that security product is coded securely.
Just remember this as we go into the software-defined world, that coders aren't perfect either, and that you can't always hire the best coder to do the job, and all of this other stuff. It's just the way it is.
Well, Juniper's had a love-hate affair with the enterprise. It comes, it goes, and its security commitment comes and goes. So maybe we're seeing the result of that sort of lack of focus over the years, or the change in focus that has weakened their development processes.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our next story. Adva Optical Networking has made an acquisition.
Most IP routing engineers wouldn't know too much about optical networking, I've discovered, and I think you need to. My belief is that optical networking is going to be coming to your IP routers in the near future. That is, instead of having a separate DWDM device, you'll start to see DWDM gear coming into your Ethernet switches. You'll be able to buy line cards, which are DWDM ready, to do DCI. And so what we've seen now is Adva Optical Networking has bought Overture. Overture has been an NFV player. They've been very big about producing telco-grade routing, firewalling, radius, all that sort of stuff in the NFV space. And the quote, the money quote, I think, from the press release from Adva was, "This means that Adva Optical Networking can now deliver customer edge or CE-based cloud services in a hybrid or NFV play-by-play environment." In other words, they see the edge of an optical network as being a software instance. Now, just to make sure I try and translate that, that could either be a router running in a VM, but it can also be white box software running on a open switch, a standard open compute style, bare metal, white brand type switch environment as the optical edge. Because we're already at the point now where you can drop an optical transceiver straight into an Ethernet switch and make it work. I think what you're seeing here is that Adva, there is a big movement amongst the carriers to start getting away from MPLS. They don't like the cost of MPLS routers to get, particularly when you start talking about terabit and multi-terabit forwarding performance. It makes more cost-effective sense to be able to deploy DWDM and then route directly into a DWDM right at the very edge of your network. So MPLS is literally CE to a P to a PE, but there is no P. It's just DWDM from the back, and build full meshes with DWDM.
This also plays into the carrier centralizing the virtualized edge, right, into the data center, which means that used to be your cell phone connected to a cell tower that connected to, some router that actually ran OSS, BSS, or whatever to do OAM type functions. And now it no longer does. That traffic is simply Ethernet tunneled directly to a data center where it terminates in a VM. And the edge is drawing further away from the user in some sense. But at the same time, you have this opposite thing where people are trying to push data to the edge to make the user experience faster. So it's almost like a clashing of requirements and concepts here between the OAM cost and making the user experience really good. And it's really hard to tell how this is going to play out.
Carriers aren't focused on the user experience. They're only focused on reducing the cost. We already know that carriers hate their customers.
I know. But the content providers are concerned about user experience. And that's what I'm saying. You have like this clash, right?
Yes.
You have like these people like Google saying, no, I want to spread data everywhere. Although I want to own all of it. But anyway, I want to spread data everywhere. And I want to make sure the user only has 2 milliseconds to get to my app. But then you have the carrier saying, no. It's okay if it takes a second, 1,000 milliseconds for the user to get to their app, because I'm going to draw all this stuff in and make it easier to manage my network. Well, somewhere in here, there's got to be something that happens that makes this work somehow.
And moving on from there, Greg, you picked out the story. I guess a software engineer in Romania got fired from his job because he was using Yahoo Messenger at work for private communications. The company said you can't do that, and they fired him. He took it to, I guess, the European Court of Human Rights to say that his rights had been violated, and the court came back and said, no, they haven't.
This is very interesting. A lot of big companies put proxy servers on the internet connection so they can log everything that you do. They can see what you're scanning, which websites you go to, and they actually intercept the SSL so that your end-to-end banking, even your personal banking, everything is seen from the desktop or anything that's inside the corporate network. But there's never been a legal basis on which to say this is allowed or disallowed. So it's one of these cases where it's easier to beg forgiveness than it is to ask for permission, and that's how the law works in general. So this guy took it to the court of law, and in this case, and there's a lot of caveats here, this is not a blanket, it's okay. The articles, and there's links in the show notes, say that it's reasonable for the employer to track what the employee is doing. So the answer is, of course, don't use your computer at work to do personal stuff, use your smartphone.
Or work from home.
If you work from home, don't make sure your VPN isn't connected.
Right. Yeah, don't VPN in.
But
or use a private VPN through the work network, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something.
Yeah.
So this is a pretty typical policy in the United States. If it's a company device, the employees essentially, you have no expectation of privacy. Where it gets tricky is that, we're at work so much, lots of people use their work computers for personal things, email, shopping, and all that. My feeling is that in the United States, at least, there's sort of a balance between companies saying, we've got a policy explicitly forbidding it, but we will implicitly sort of allow it as long as you don't abuse the privilege, as long as you aren't like surfing porn 5 hours a day or binging on Netflix at work. Most companies will generally be cool, but they have in their back pocket legal repercussions if they need it.
That's partly a practical issue. Making a legal case that's going to stick is very hard. But we've also seen situations where so-and-so from such-and-such a company, we've got records of them browsing hate sites, and therefore the company is implicated, and that's bad PR, and companies want to prevent that. What I'm saying is this is another situation where the corporate legal ramifications of this type of discussion haven't been seen out in the courts of law because no one's been winging to bring a case. Normally what happens is the company goes to the employee and says, you've been doing these things, they're in breach of our policy, we're asking you to leave the company. Whether you need to be pushed or you choose to go voluntarily is up to you. But nobody's taken to court. This is one of the very few times where I've seen it go to court and the ruling go against the person. And validate that technology. To some extent, if I was a proxy manufacturer or somebody who scanned for malware, I'd be quite pleased about this in Europe, where privacy actually is higher than might be in, say, other parts of the world.
Certainly. Yeah, there's a marketing slogan somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Sticking with the European Union, apparently Apple has come to an agreement with some European telcos to make it easier for Apple customers to shift to Android, meaning they can take their contacts, their other data that might be on an Apple device, shift it over to an Android device. This is a story coming from The Telegraph.
So The Telegraph in the UK, it is part of the governmental policy throughout Europe to allow customers to switch from carrier to carrier at will. And that is actually a regulation. And the purpose of that is to get the best possible result for customers. So it's capitalism is perfect when you can take your service and move it from one place to the other. And you'll see this quite a lot across all of the European countries. You can switch from bank to bank, and the banks are required to move your accounts for you. It's not up to you to do all the hard work. It's a lovely piece of capitalism, all wrapped up in socialism. And it allows for people to rapidly move from one company to another company, say, every 6 months or every year as contract periods reduce. So now that Apple has a tool to allow people to move to Android and back again, this is good for customers because they can move around as they see fit and all the data moves, and Apple's got less of a lock-in. And that's what the regulation is there to prevent. It promotes capitalism by preventing lock-in.
And I should say that there's no official word from Apple on this. This was an unnamed insider industry source that there's a private agreement to develop this tool to let customers shift their data. I found that interesting because my opinion is that Apple's entire business model is to create that walled garden that sort of locks you into all of their services, which is one of the reasons I find using Apple so frustrating sometimes.
Yeah, that's the privacy play they're playing as well, right? It's part of the walled garden. Stay in our walled garden and everything will be private.
The flip side of that is the same walled garden we've seen from enterprise IT players like EMC and Cisco.
Yep.
If you're inside of our ecosystem, we can innovate quickly, although what we've actually seen is they don't actually innovate all that quickly. They slow down to maximize their profits and use the lock-in to leverage, but the flip side of it is that if you're in control of the entire device and the whole experience, you can continue to change it rapidly. And Apple, at least, has every year reduced, continued to innovate on its base platform and its hardware, and doesn't. I believe that Apple might reap rewards from the lock-in, but they equally use it to accelerate the rate of change in the industry by delivering new features and new capabilities for which they charge generously, I might add. They don't give them away for free. So if you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
I think there's a balance here, and Apple's walking down the middle of that line between lock-in and innovation, new features, new capabilities, and charging a very generous price.
So you're saying the trade-off of lock-in is faster innovation?
Yeah, in theory and in practice, Apple's doing that. In theory, in enterprise IT, the practice is not what's actually happening. We have enterprise IT vendors delivering high-priced products in their locked-in ecosystems and then failing to innovate because it doesn't make any. You make more profits by not innovating, by keeping static product lines.
Or you innovate by just throwing things together that you already have and calling it innovation because it's simpler and cheaper, which creates a lot of technical debt. But
look at storage arrays. How much innovation has happened in storage arrays until Flash came along to disrupt those players? Yeah.
We've got some other news to get to, but before we do, I just want to take a second to thank our sponsor, ThousandEyes. So as your network expands, it's got cloud services, you have ISPs, third-party providers. It's really hard to get that visibility, and that's a problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. So what ThousandEyes does is gives you visibility into every network that you rely on, so your corporate network, internet, cloud services, and you can do it all in one place because they've got agents that are deployed in locations all across the globe and inside your enterprise. So together, you get this vantage point that provides the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. So for instance, with ThousandEyes, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, whether it's BGP routing, DNS, and web servers. You can precisely pinpoint root causes of problems like device faults, congestion, DDoS, and so on. And you can also take all this data and the insights that come from it and share it with your vendors to say, hey, here's what's going on and here's how I can prove it. You can also share it with customers to say, here's why we're experiencing this issue. And it helps you resolve problems faster. And ThousandEyes is giving a special deal for Packet Pushers followers, for listeners. You can go to ThousandEyes.com/Packet Pushers. You get a free t-shirt, and they also will let you sign up for a free account where you can scan three devices. So it's ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see.
If you've ever run an internet service, like offered a service over the internet, and then you realize that you've got no way of knowing what's actually happening on the internet, is the BGP tables flapping? Are the carriers going down or up that's causing problems to your customers who are accessing your service? ThousandEyes is one way to get visibility into this. If you've never thought about getting visibility into the internet, that's what ThousandEyes is for you. Check it out. And a free t-shirt.
And everybody loves t-shirts.
And monitoring three locations is a good way to get started.
Yeah, so check it out. ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers. We like to talk about Amazon, being both a provider and a competitor because it builds services that customers can come and use and then starts to sort of take over different markets by starting to offer services that maybe some of its competitors also sell on Amazon or build on Amazon. A couple of stories. So an example of this is Amazon Workmail. It's Amazon's own, you know, business-centric email system. They just released it a couple weeks ago. Let's use an Outlook client, and the idea is that you can get rid of Exchange using AWS. I just saw another company called Intermedia that's sort of using Amazon against itself. It's running hosted Microsoft Exchange on AWS. So they're actually, I like this sort of competition thing coming back on Amazon here.
So once again, Amazon's taking open source software and turning it into money because that's what their Workmail is built on. There's quite a few open source projects that allow you to use your Outlook client and make it look like an Exchange server. And of course, there are other companies who are running genuine Microsoft Exchange on AWS, but they usually do so at a substantial financial disadvantage because they're actually using Microsoft Exchange server and there's licenses and CALs and it's usually punitively expensive. I can't imagine why you would want to run dedicated Microsoft Exchange on via Intermedia unless you've got some very esoteric things. You would much rather use Azure's Office 365 service or Workmail from Amazon, I think. The pricing just wouldn't make sense to me.
Well, apparently this dedicated Microsoft Exchange where they actually run it on dedicated systems, it's not multi-tenant. I guess it's like $12 to $16 per user per month. So there's that, you know, a sort of fixed price. There's less variability.
Workmail's like $5 a month or $6 a month per person.
Right. I think Intermedia would probably say that the deal is, you know, we're not multi-tenant. This is a dedicated server host. It's all yours. You're not sharing it with other customers. I think that argument sometimes sways people.
You can do that. You can buy reserved instances on AWS, or you can even buy bare metal servers on AWS, I think. But the price of hosting Microsoft Exchange doesn't make sense. I'm not sure that I would continue to consider this as a viable option. Just get rid of it. Email's not a feature, it's a bug. And running an email server, if there's one thing we've learned from Google Mail and Yahoo and, you know, those types of companies is running an email server doesn't add any value to your business. Getting rid of it makes perfect sense unless you've got some sort of confidentiality problem, in which case, you know, still you shouldn't be using email to communicate because everything you send over the internet goes in the clear. So, you know. Wrong tool, wrong job.
Well, I guess Intermedia has approximately 70,000 customers, so they seem to be doing something right. This story caught my eye. The CEO of T-Mobile had to release an apology for saying bad things about the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is an advocacy group for privacy on the internet. So the background is T-Mobile has this service called Binge On, where you, if you're watching like Netflix or YouTube or something, and YouTube and Netflix sign up for this Binge On deal as partners, the content that you're streaming doesn't count against T-Mobile's data caps. So it's essentially letting you watch video that doesn't count against your data caps if you're using partners of this Binge On service. EFF took a look at it and found out that T-Mobile is actually rate limiting data, all the streaming that their users are doing, including companies that aren't part of this Binge On service. So T-Mobile is essentially just rate limiting everything that you stream over T-Mobile's network. Hmm. The EFF said, hey, this could be a net neutrality violation. I guess the CEO didn't like it, and he used some very foul language to say, who the F are you, EFF, and yeah. what are you doing?
I really like the fact that he's a really passionate CEO, and he gets out there, and he wears a pink T-shirt. And, you know, on one hand, you've got to like John Legere for saying things that no other CEO would. It's pretty cool. But on the other hand, he must have been pretty upset when he thought he had a good thing going and then suddenly realized it could be derailed by the EFF calling it net neutrality, which is the last thing they want to be subject to. But absolutely. It absolutely is a net neutrality issue as far as I can tell.
Now, there's actually been a huge long thread on Nanog mailing list about this, actually, about this specific thing, this Binge On. Now, not about the CEO saying nasty things, but about Binge On and about how it's interesting that the net neutrality people aren't after T-Mobile for this, or how do you square this with the whole net neutrality thing? And does this actually destroy net neutrality, or does it, you know, how does this play into this? What does this actually mean, this whole Binge On thing? Mm.
So we had an email from a listener the other day, and he has a YouTube Red subscription, which means he can subscribe to all the YouTube he likes. But importantly, he's on T-Mobile and he can stream our podcasts if they were on YouTube without paying for them on his bandwidth. So first of all, ha ha for living in the USA where bandwidth actually matters and how much you use. because I have a plan which is bandwidth free. Same if you live in Australia. But, you know, maybe you should fix the root of the problem where bandwidth is actually should be free, and you should have that expectation that carriers would give away bandwidth because it doesn't cost them much. The second thing is, I understand that, and we are looking at trying to get our podcasts onto YouTube so you can listen to them and take advantage of this, if that's important to you. I think on the whole, I'd much rather have John Legere out there being passionate and colorful and engaging and getting it wrong every now and then apologizing, which is fine.
Yeah.
I think on balance, it was a fair deal. What I would like to see them is to stop breaching net neutrality, what I believe to be net neutrality.
But Greg, when you said putting packet pushers on YouTube, I just got the very frightening vision of the picture of you on the YouTube channel as the video for an entire podcast.
No, we aren't going to do video. We're just going to put the audio files into the YouTube so people can stream them YouTube, if that's what you wish.
But, you know, just something about having your picture on the screen for an hour, just like, I don't know.
No, nobody needs to see my face. That's why we do podcasts.
maybe we'll put up pictures of Ethan's cats or something instead.
It'll be cat pictures all the way down, or turtles.
Turtles.
Because it's turtles all the way down.
Turtles all the way down. Our last story for today, Michael Dell back in the news. He apparently and some investors have been buying up TV stations. And you might think, why is Michael Dell and some investors buying up a lot of TV stations? It looks like the FCC is going to start taking some bandwidth that had been reserved for airwave bandwidth that had been reserved for television and repurpose it for wireless communication. So now he's got a whole bunch of wireless property that could be very potentially lucrative. There was a speculation, I think, in Fortune magazine that he could make up to $4 billion on this auction.
Yes. Now, there's a new wireless standard. I'm trying to remember the exact number. I'm sure somebody can tell me. A new Wi-Fi standard that uses a very small amount of spectrum in the 700 kilohertz to 800 kilohertz, which is television spectrum. The reason that you want to have Wi-Fi in this spectrum is because at 700 kilohertz, it goes through walls. So 2.4 gig and 5 gig can't go through walls very well. That's why we have a maximum range of 100 meters. And in the case of 54 gig, the maximum practical distance for high performance is about 25 meters. Getting into the 700 megahertz spectrum, means that you're going to be like TVs. You can transmit a signal in the 700 megahertz. It'll go for miles. Yeah, the signal will be strong, and it'll go straight through a lot of walls that today Wi-Fi won't go through. And this is a big deal. I'm trying to remember the IEEE 802.1 something W, I think it was. I can't remember. And that's what it is. Now, those spectrums in everywhere in the world are free and open, except for the US. And so maybe that's what he's trying to do.
It should be 802.11 TV.
That's what it should be. I doubt it is, though, because the IEEE isn't that logical about things. But, you know, Greg, to me, this is just another instance of the whole thing about net neutrality, right? I mean, does government getting involved in these things actually always help? I mean, as you said, in other places, this spectrum is free. And so apparently someone somewhere tried to make sure that television was protected by protecting this particular space in the U.S. and nobody else thought to do so. So it's going to make someone a lot of money over just getting through some red tape or whatever, essentially, is what it seems like it comes down to me. Sometimes you wonder, well, really, do we need to be doing this specifically? Yes. Sometimes to the statement there ought to be a law, the answer is no, there shouldn't.
Okay, so I've just remembered it's 802.11ah, and from the Wikipedia page, extended range, making it useful for rural communications and offloading cell phone tower traffic. I wonder if that's what he's trying to do, is get a hold of some spectrum for carrier to carrier. So it's, the reason that it's important is because it might be used for offloading cell phone tower traffic. Maybe one of the wireless people could pop up, and we'll talk more about it in a future show.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Thanks to our sponsor, ThousandEyes, the network intelligence platform that delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on. You can resolve issues faster and improve the delivery of your applications. You can monitor network from 3 locations for free and choose a free t-shirt when you visit ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers. Greg, if folks want more from you, where can they find you?
Find me on the internet at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters is at etherealmind, and also hanging around on LinkedIn, et cetera, et cetera.
Russ, thank you for jumping in to join us for today's show. Where can folks find you?
Well, I'm getting pretty active on Slack. I'm on Twitter at Routing Geek. I'm on Packet Pushers from time to time whenever I get around to it. I blog at Network. I blog all over all sorts of other places. I'm pretty easy to find on LinkedIn, so just look me up.
All right, look them up. Please check out our newsletter, Link Propagation. It gets you a weekly dose of essential IT news, vendor announcements, and must-read blogs. That's at packetpushers.net/link-propagation. If you like the show, please let us know on Facebook or visit us on LinkedIn. And if you would, leave a review on iTunes. And thanks for listening.